As we were discussing last night on the program, getting the dirt on your opponents and getting a friendly journalist to smear an opponent is an old political trick. But what happens when the information comes from intelligence agencies? Does it serve a national or public interest? And when used as a political weapon, does it compromise the integrity of the agencies? They sound like Dorothy Dixes, don't they? In Australia, there's a rich history of politicians using intelligence to bolster their preferred policy positions and agendas while denigrating an opposition. It's all laid out by whistleblower Justin McPhee, whose new book, Spinning Secrets, Politics and Intelligence in Australia, is very intelligently published by Monash University Press. Justin teaches across the social and political sciences at RMIT. He's a specialist in intelligence history and national security issues, and he's got a clearance to join me now. Welcome to the program, Justin.
Oh, thank you, Philip. We are clear to go, yes.
Now, to me, the great case, the biggest case in my experience was, of course, the invention of WMDs to encourage the invasion of Iraq. And as we know, that was a classic case of disinformation and misinformation, much of it provided by intelligence agencies.
Yeah, one of the big problems with Iraq is that I found it's actually not that unique. And if you look back at the history of these things, it's anything but. But as you mentioned, there are many problems with what occurred in Iraq, especially in terms of how the intelligence was used, or should we say even abused. We can see the intelligence being used to justify some very contentious policy decisions. In fact, it seems to me that the intelligence was actually driving the policy, which is a bit of a problem because intelligence agencies of all stripes are intended to be divorced from politics. But what we see is intelligence being used to try and get public support to justify those policies. And we can see intelligence being used in a public setting by political leaders to justify their arguments. And I think the other interesting thing about that case is we can see a lot of buck passing when it comes to those weapons not appearing. And we see the intelligence agencies being scapegoated and blamed.
But Justin, I well remember Hans Blick coming on the program before the wretched war.
Oh, yes.
He knew, and the whole world knew that it was a beat up, and there wasn't popular support for that war. It didn't work. But the war went ahead. But okay, let's not bog down in Iraq. let's, as you suggest, go back. It isn't new. And I was fascinated by your examples from the early days of Federation, of all things.
Yes.
Tell me about Barton and Deakin.
Well, yeah, there's some very interesting cases there. And no one has really looked at these cases. One of the earliest examples I found of this sort of behavior was in 1901 during the Barton administration. And they sent Wilson Lecouteur, who's probably Australia's first domestic spy. They sent him to the New Hebrides, which is now Vanuatu, to collect intelligence on what they called the aggressive and belligerent behaviour of the French. Now, the Australian government had actively sought an extension of the British Empire that would include the annexation of the New Hebrides into the British Commonwealth in the interests of protecting Australian security. And what they didn't want to happen was the French to use Vanuatu and its glorious harbours for their naval fleet. So they sent Wilson Lecouteur over there to suss out the situation. And he wrote a number of reports or intelligence reports. And
he's spying against the French, and he's got a French name. Explain that to me.
Yes. Well, he was fluent in French, and he had worked on the islands for a number of years. Of course, he was just a traveller. He wasn't what we would term a spy by any means in modern standards. And this was very much the habit in the early colonial and early Federation period, is that many of these spies were just people that had knowledge of a specific area, and they would nominate themselves to the government, as Wilson Le Couture did, and they were sent there to gain knowledge. And as a French speaker, he was able to sort of interact with the locals and see what they wanted and see what the French were up to.
Now, during World War One, Billy Hughes turns to the intelligence agencies to help his pro-conscription case.
Some of the most notoriously bad examples we see of this sort of behaviour occurred under Billy Hughes's time as Prime Minister. And as we're probably aware, that during this time we had the conscription referendums going on about whether Australia would send its troops overseas under compulsory military conscription. Now, Hughes, of course, was very much pro-conscription, and they'd had just set up the Counter-Espionage Bureau, and much of its work was just looking at Hughes's political enemies to find dirt on them and find any way that they could possibly discredit these people.
That couldn't possibly happen now, though, could it? Not with people like Dutton and Judge.
Never.
Perish the thought. But Billy was all for it, yeah?
Oh, Billy loved it, yeah. And the director of the Counter-Espionage Bureau, George Stewart, him and Prime Minister Hughes were very close. They shared the same political outlook, the same goals. George Stewart, the director, was very much in league with Prime Minister Hughes, and he had no scruples with doing this. And we also know that Hughes was Attorney General, I should say, at the same time. So there was almost no legislation, nothing to stop him from doing this. And he also did this with the Irish too, because he didn't like the Irish at all.
Oh, that's perfectly reasonable. But I didn't realise that they were spying on the Wobblies, the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, to younger listeners, and they were also censoring whatever they could, publications of lectures and talks unfavourable.
Absolutely. They even, towards the end of the war, because they couldn't really get away with this for as long as they wanted, and some people within the intelligence community were resisting to this, and they end up trying to set up their own private intelligence bureau, which was called the Australian Protective League. And that was made up of citizens of Australia who would volunteer to spy on the Wobblies, the Irish, and anyone else that caused problems. And
this is sort of vigilante stuff.
Absolutely. Citizen vigilantes, yes. So that was a very interesting time in our history, where intelligence played a huge role in helping Hughes try to defeat opposition to his policy goals. But, of course, you know, the Australian people, they're aware of this, and they won't put up with it. And twice the conscription referendum was defeated.
As, of course, the anti-com legislation of Menzies went under as well. Now, tell us how intelligence was used for political ends during the 30s. And in this case, I'm thinking Lang and the New Guard.
Yeah, well, this is a really controversial and strange episode of our history. The New Guard was set up by Ian Campbell in Sydney, and it was a very right-wing citizens sort of vigilante force, pretty much taking the lead from the Australian Protective League. And, of course, they were very concerned with what Jack Lang was doing at the time and all of his quote-unquote socialist proclivities. And they wanted to sort of overthrow the Lang government, and they had actually even tried to kidnap members of the Lang cabinet at times, because
I've never heard that.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, this is all down in the archives.
Oh,
and
that's
in
a good idea.
Well, they were going to kidnap the Lang cabinet if it had gone too far with its socialist proclivities. But this was very much a right-wing establishment set up to help the police and it, and the military if things should get out of hand, meaning should go too far left. but, you know, there are also other organisations that we might have heard of that formed in Victoria around the same time called the White Army and the Old Guard. And, you know, these organisations had many, many senior military figures in them as well. So it's very controversial about what they were actually doing. But it seems, again, that they were set up as sort of these citizens' resistance movements to keep in check things politically if they went a bit too askew, shall we say.
I hope no one from RMIT is listening tonight because they probably don't realise what a viper they're nursing to their bosom in you, Justin McPhee. Now,
well, no, they probably don't.
At the time of World War II, there are numerous overlapping and competing agencies, rather like there was before 9/11.
Mm. Yeah.
Did this lead to an increased politicisation of intelligence?
Yeah, well, the thing about at the start of the Second World War, we had five intelligence bodies that had been set up, and none of them would work together. They were pretty much their own sort of fiefdoms. They wouldn't cooperate and, you know, they were very sort of cumbersome. They weren't, you know, they had this fixation with the left and communism and things like that. And the Menzies government tried to fix this, and they set up an inquiry. They got an old English fellow, John Morwood, to come over. He was a member of MI5.
Now, I'm going to spell that because it's an interesting name. M-A-W-H-O-O-D, John Morwood.
John Morwood, yeah, that's correct.
And he's a British Army officer.
Well, yeah, look, he was a British Army officer, but he came over with the endorsement of MI5. As with a lot of things, actually getting a clear understanding of what Morwood did in the UK is pretty difficult. But the records do tell us that he had MI5's consent to come out here, and Menzies took to Morwood, and he wanted him to go in and look at the intelligence services and try and sort all this out. Now, he was to investigate military intelligence as well initially, and some of the cabinet did not like that, and especially the army did not like this. And they sort of intervened and they tried to discredit Morwood, and they dug up dirt on him and they followed him around and surveilled him. And eventually Menzies appointed Alexander Duncan to help Morwood conduct his inquiry. But of course, this caused a massive sort of stir within the intelligence community, within government.
Well, it would, because he described them as incompetent.
Absolutely. Morwood's report of the military intelligence was absolutely scathing. And he did literally call them incompetent, and they had no idea what they were doing. But of course, he was stopped from investigating military intelligence. Now, the connection here is that a lot of military intelligence is quite linked to the New Guard. And there are theories, and these are theories that I look at in the book, that there was a bit of deliberate obfuscation there, so he couldn't look at the connection between the Australian military and the New Guard. And Morwood actually says this in his report. He says, you know, that all of his work in the investigation was obfuscated, and so that he could not directly look at this connection between the military and the New Guard.
So much to cover, so little time. We've mentioned Menzies' desire to, you know, have the Communist Party banned, so he gets a list of unionists with commo affiliations. He reads it out in Parliament. It was full of mistakes, wasn't it?
And it was. Well, he had to retract that statement. And the other fascinating thing about that case, which is quite well known and is a clear example of using intelligence to discredit your opponents, is that the Director General, Jeffrey Reid of ASIO, he had a big problem with this. And this hasn't been really spoken about much. And in the archives, we can see that Jeffrey Reid is saying, look, I gave you this information in confidence. If I had any knowledge that you were going to do this with it, I would not have, I would have strongly advised against doing so.
See, ASIO needed new blood, and at one point they were trying to recruit me. I think you've read my file.
And I love your file, Philip.
Finally got it, though heavily redacted, I was shocked to see they decided not to proceed because they thought I was mentally unstable. I don't make the cut in your book. I'm very hurt.
Well, you know, there was so much to choose from, Philip. I had to sort of make really editorial decisions. The great thing, I think, about your file is it shows the caliber of assessments that they were giving to people like yourself at the time. If you permit me to go into it, I have it here. And it says,
well, they did. They said I was mentally unstable, but
well, yes, they said you're highly intelligent.
Yeah, they said that.
Extremely egotistical.
But I mean, they got that right. But I was so hurt that they didn't recruit me. Mind you, I would have been a double agent, I think, at that time.
Yeah, and I think it actually says that Mr. Adams would consider any approach by ASIO a huge joke. I've got to applaud that. That's great.
So ASIO regularly used members of the media to push their agenda, didn't it?
Oh yes. This is really something huge, because this is pretty much what led Gough Whitlam, or one of the big reasons that led Gough Whitlam into calling the Hope Review after he was elected. Since the 1950s, ASIO had actively been intervening in the media, and it had been cultivating journalists, newspaper editors, and other representatives as part of its what it called its counter-propaganda and exposure measures known as spoiling operations. But basically what that meant was they would feed certain information, mainly information on communists, to the friendly press in order to have them sort of publish salacious details about members of the Communist Party and things like that. And this is well documented too. And Gough, he made them, when he got elected, he made them well, there's a press statement by Gough, and he actually says that there were 16 newspapers that were involved with this, and he published a full list. And, you know, this includes, like, The Age, the Financial Times, and a number of very Herald and Weekly Times groups. All of these people were involved in it. And maybe that's what they were trying to get to you about.
You know, I remember, and I won't go into details, when the when a very famous editor of an Australian newspaper, when his secretary, we sussed out, was probably working for ASIO, what a point of entry for them to be able to listen into the phone calls between virtually every powerful person in the country and a top newspaper editor.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's one way to look at it is, yes, you have access to a lot of people coming in and out of those offices, but you also have such a powerful source of disseminating your political views.
And now, I think, sorry to interrupt, but we've got so little time. You note that there are several layers of oversight now for the intelligence agencies, but there's virtually no scrutiny on the politicians who might misuse it.
Yeah, this is one of the big findings, or the major points of my book, is that there is very good oversight these days of our intelligence services, although there could be improvements made, of course, but there's virtually nothing to – there's no accountability, there's no public scrutiny available to how politicians use the intelligence that they're given. And this has been the case right back to the times of Billy Hughes. The only way that we can sort of have a say, if we know about it, is to vote them out of office. No questions can be raised in Parliament about these matters. So question time's out of any sort of way of bringing scrutiny to these political leaders. So this is one of the big things. The Attorney General's and now I suppose the Department of Home Affairs, they need to be sort of held account about how they use the intelligence that they're given.
Justin, I should know the answer to this, but I don't. Is the D-notice system still in place, which prevents media dealing with certain topics?
Well, the D-notice is – this was actually – I'm not sure too much about whether we use the D-notice system. I think possibly that's something that the British have used.
Most no, we certainly had it, and and some newspapers would sign up. Media groups would sign up and agree that they wouldn't, for example, mention where the Petrovs lived these days. And, you know, there's a long list of national security issues. Anyway, look, it's forgive me, it's a detour. So what are you recommending? What should happen?
Well, I'm recommending things like more bipartisan oversight. That is, having more of a balanced committee, that is, of political parties who can oversee. Obviously, these political leaders need to be vetted and, have some knowledge in the field. But even things like the National Security Committee of Cabinet, they're all made up of members of one party. That needs to change, and we need to have members from a number of parties just looking at how intelligence is used in the political sphere. That would be a big help and a good start.
What about ministerial oversight? Doesn't that lead to politicisation in and of itself?
Yeah, well, this has also been a huge problem, and we saw that throughout the 50s, 60s and 70s. And it was a big problem under the 1956 ASIO Act because the Director General could be terminated under Section 12 of that Act if he refused to obey a lawful order by a minister, which means that if a minister requested intelligence, he had to oblige by that.
We've got to wind it up, Justin, unfortunately. Sure. Look, I got you on, and the deal was I wouldn't give RMIT your ASIO file, so I'll stand by that. You can trust me. I won't leak it. I'll only tweet it, so that doesn't count. We've been talking to Justin McPhee from RMIT, and he's author of, let me hold it up, Spinning the Secrets of State, Politics and Intelligence in Australia, and it's published by Monash University Press. You should have known better.